Blog Talk Radio.
Geeks United.
Yeah.
It makes me feel so warm and happy and everything whenever I hear it.
Does, because you know that movie geeks are right around the corner when you hear that theme.
We know it's
safe. how you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm good, good, good. This is going to be just a fun kind of say whatever's on our mind about the movies of the week kind of show. We need one of those every once in a while.
We do. We really do. And I think this is a good week, as good a weekend as any to do it. So,
yeah, 4th of July, which tends to be the biggest movie weekend of the year.
Except for the actual day, the actual holiday, the actual, like, the 4th of July day is not considered.
Very strange.
But the weekend itself is, you know, I think they're going to have to just rename it Will Smith Weekend. I really do.
That's what they've done, you know, and working at, having used to work in the theater industry, Christmas, you know, holiday is obviously the second biggest for, I mean, Memorial Day, obviously they released the first big summer picture,
mm-hmm.
Memorial Day, you know, used to, and now they pushed that back 3 weeks, but Christmas was like, you know, nobody really on Christmas Eve until the nighttime, I think Christmas was just packed. From day to night, people want to get out of the house, away from their families, or in a different venue with their families, outside
get away
of the house.
They want to get away from the bloatedness of the holiday.
Yeah. They, you know, they're all asleep in the theater on turkey, and they need something to keep them awake. Well, the top five are top five movies this weekend. The estimates are out.
Okay.
And here's what we're looking at. Actually, let's go through the top ten.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do that.
Don't start with number one. We need to build suspense. Like there's any suspense to be.
You're right. Okay. Well, you start with number ten, my friend. Let me get to that page, and you.
All right. I'll give you the top five, and I'll take the top ten. No, let's do it the opposite way around. I'll give you ten through six, and I'll do five through one.
Okay. Let me just get to the appropriate page.
Teamwork.
All right. We're starting at number ten.
Yes.
Number ten. Your buddy and mine, a master thespian, according to my brother, although he hasn't seen his last couple of movies, he might want to rethink that statement. You Don't Mess with the Zohan, which made, let's see, this $2 million this weekend with Mr.
It's
Adam Sandler.
Yeah, just a little over $5 million away from the $100 million mark, which, you know.
He still has power.
Where,
he still has it.
Where Sandler movies exist in that stratosphere, no matter what the quality. But I actually wouldn't mind seeing this movie. This movie actually looks funny to me.
John Turturro is hilarious in this film. I won't lie to you. He's very funny.
Yeah.
And it's worth going to see just for him alone.
Yeah. Okay. All right, number nine.
Sex in the City. We've already had a long talk about this film. And,
we've talked about this film more than
a
couple of guys are supposed to.
Entity should.
All right, so Sex in the City. What did it bring in? What is it at here?
Let me hold on. You got to forgive me. My computer keeps freezing on me, but $2.3 million.
Okay. So that stands at $144, almost $145 million so far. So it's like doubled, more than doubled what it cost to make.
Yes, it did.
To tell you the far-reaching implications of this, I mean, not only... I'm sure there'll be another Sex in the City film unless, you know, the contracts and people want an ungodly amount of money or something to come back. But the far-reaching implications of this is now we're 18 months away, we're told, from a Friends feature film.
Now, read that.
That would not have happened without the Sex and the City.
I heard that's not completely true. That's just a rumor. That's not.
Well, it went out on AP. It wasn't like one of those Us Weeklies saying that Angelina gave birth.
Okay. No, but I have read when on our friend's site, Film Arcade, someone had posted a thing saying this is not accurate about the Friends movie. But I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, it might be a leak. It might be a leak. But if you think about it, those guys, I mean, and girls, as appealing as they are, they haven't really found their stuff in feature films yet. I mean, they need it. I mean,
you don't think David Schwimmer's work in the Madagascar, or its upcoming sequel, is okay? All right, I'm gonna, I was gonna make an animated movie too. Never mind. Okay.
But if you think Jennifer Aniston, I mean, she's got all the publicity in the world, but something just doesn't connect with her when she does a film. People don't. There's no connection there. I don't know what that is.
You don't even think, like, the films that she's made, the smaller films, like The Good Girl or Friends with Money?
No, I think she's great. I think she's great. I'm talking about her grosses matching her publicity.
Oh, okay. No, you're absolutely right. Number 8 is a shocker.
Right.
And that would be Kit Kettridge, An American Girl. This is a film we talked about last week because my brother took his daughter to see it. When it was just in limited release, but they wide released it on Wednesday, and it came in at number 8 at $3.6 million. This is considered a disaster in wide release, this film with Abigail Breslin. Now it's gotten nothing but great reviews, but I think they made a mistake by releasing it after Wally.
But look at it this way. It's in half the screens that... the Hancock is.
Right.
So in that sense, it's almost like a specialty release so far. I mean,
no, you're right.
Yeah, and it has increased by 3,264%.
Okay, you're looking at the same page as me. Okay. No, but I think they would have done better had they, instead of doing the platform release, which they got a lot of, as of today, they got a lot of criticism for, Picture House.
Right. Right.
If they had did wide release this when they originally released it, because they would have done much better. I think it's hard, and with all the, you have Kung Fu Panda as well. Besides Wall-E, there are a lot of other choices out there for families. So,
well, you're right. Go to number 7.
Number 7 is Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which is at. Made $3.9 million this weekend and is at $306 million. Regardless of what you may think about this film, this is incredible.
Yeah.
There's no... Yeah. It's got power, and the film has legs. There's no denying that.
It's got the mojo, baby.
Mm-hmm.
Number 6. Go ahead. Number
6, and then it's all, 5 through 1 is all you, baby.
Okay. I know. Sorry.
That's okay. The Incredible Hulk at $4.9 million, altogether $124 million, which is good. No one's denying that. But I don't know if this is going to gross more than the Ang Lee one.
It's strange because Chris and I were talking to each other earlier today, and it's strange how you can have a $125 million grosser and it still be a disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that tells you where we are in the industry today.
Yes, it does. And it's a good film. It's a fun film. I like it a lot. It doesn't make you think what was if this reboot was necessary or not.
Just a crowded marketplace.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Number 5 is Kung Fu Panda. Those DreamWorks Animation guys, they get it right. $7.5 million. For a total over the course of 5 weeks of $193 million,
that's
just under
incredible.
$200 million. Another mega hit. And those aren't inexpensive to produce. I know they take years to produce, but there's a fallacy that they're cheap.
They're not cheap at all.
No.
If that's cheap,
$130 million
dollars
to make. Yeah. Number 4 is Get Smart. Which, fourth place. It missed number 3. It missed it by that much. Terrible joke. No. It made just over $11 million. It's just under $100 million total gross, which is great. I mean, man, all these movies are really kind of, I mean, they're thriving out there.
They
are. For all of them. Number three is Wanted. Angelina Jolie, you gotta love that.
Yeah, I think this, besides Mr. and Mrs. Smith, is gonna turn out to be one of her biggest, in the first Tomb Raider movie, her biggest box office success.
A lot of fun this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a clip from it. Can I play a clip? I love playing clips.
Do it. My brothers are watching this right now, but go for it.
Here it is, Wanted.
You know how they say, someday a girl's going to come along and change your world forever? You have no idea.
Could you let me edit the next corner, please?
Please be quiet.
6 weeks ago, I was just like you. And then I met her.
I thought he'd be taller.
I really think you have me mixed up with somebody else.
I want you to curve the bullet.
I don't know what that means.
Only a few people in the world have this ability, and you are one of them.
It's crazy.
Shoot the target.
Let your instincts guide you. This is your destiny. Join us.
That's great. Only you gotta love it. Only in a big dumb summer movie, which is what this is, and that's its charm.
I agree.
Is there a lot of importance pressed upon being able to curve the bullet? Only a couple of people in the world can do this.
I bet you Paul Schrader knows how to do it, but I mean, I really
curve the bullet. Oh, that's classic. WALL-E comes in second place, another Pixar masterpiece.
It is a masterpiece.
Yeah,
it really is.
They just cannot lose. I mean, and you think of an unlikely plot for something that, you know, because when we saw it, we thought, man, this is a little risky.
Mm-hmm.
But families are eating it up. I mean, if it works, if the story's there, then there's no argument. You know.
Right. My mom took my niece to see it yesterday, and I think my mom got into it more than my niece.
That's what I'm hearing from families, and God bless them for that, because I mean, for so many years, parents have been tortured taking their kids to Pokemon and all that kind of stuff. You know? So the Disney really takes into account, you know, there's the other half of the audience in the theater there.
Mm-hmm.
They always have. That's been a good strength of theirs. And number one, first place, of course, is Mr. 4th of July, as Jerry referred to him. Hancock made over the weekend, it made $66 million from its original release on, was it Wednesday?
Yes. Or Tuesday night, if you want it. Tuesday night was...
Yeah. $107 million. A massive opening. Will Smith hasn't gone anywhere. He is still as relevant...
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no argument to be made against that.
I know. Yeah, you can't argue against it. But I will argue against the movie, because I checked it out this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You checked it out by Wednesday night's show. You'd already seen it. So.
I went to the Tuesday night screening, and while I like the first half, I think the second half of this film, I mean, we talked about it earlier, but I want to hear your thoughts, because I was rambling on about it Wednesday. So please, the floor is yours.
Here it comes. I'll play a clip from it, and then I'll offer my opinion on the film. I know everyone's just breathless to hear it. Here we go.
I don't know who I am.
Amnesia. You know, the blow to the head.
Yeah, well, that's what they figured.
You don't remember anything.
Only thing I had in my pocket was bubblegum, 2 movie tickets, Boris Karloff, Frankenstein. But no ID, nothing. I went to sign out. The nurse asked me for my John Hancock. I actually thought that's who I was.
How come I didn't hear any of this? I didn't read about it in the newspapers?
It was probably in the papers 80 years ago.
80 years ago?
Oh, I don't age.
That's nice.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the movie, unlike Will Smith's character, gets old real fast. I recognize Will Smith's charm, and actually, I was sold on this premise.
Right.
I mean, what an undeniably great, dynamic, funny. I mean, it's just built in there on the premise. It's just the screenwriter and the filmmaker's thing to mess up, and they did. First of all, I don't think it had the right director, or I don't think it was directed correctly, because Peter Berg directed this. He's done a number of films, and he's a great actor as well. But he directs it like he directed his last film, The Kingdom. Very tight, mm-hmm. very claustrophobic, very gritty realism. This movie is a comedy; it needs to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels too claustrophobic the way it's shot.
That's a valid argument right there.
It needs to be directed with buoyancy and not, you know, stark realism. And it's just so tight on the faces. And it something dawned on me as I was watching it. Such tight close-ups all the way through. Without distance, you don't feel like you can really relax with these characters and get to know them and appreciate their their charm, especially Will Smith. And the second thing is it's begging to be an R-rated movie. And Aaron said this to me. He said it's begging to be an R-rated movie, and I agree. And I'll take it one step further. I think they should have modeled it. I think they should have modeled it as the Bad Santa of superhero movies.
I would think that would have been better, because the first half is giving us that. And then once he becomes a super and accepts his role as a superhero, I think the movie dies.
Right.
I really do believe that. I think there's some promise in the first half hour, a lot of promise that's squandered.
But, you know, in something like Bad Santa, which is obviously the most offensive movie, but I find it so amusing.
I found it cathartic as Bad Santa. When I saw that when it came out, I couldn't stop laughing.
Me neither.
The Futurist has words for you, by the way. Just check the chat room.
Okay, I'll go to the flow of the thing in Bad Santa. You know where it's going, you know, in the back of your mind, but it's kind of insidious. It's not like
you're right. No,
you know, in this one, it just seems so obvious, and the transition doesn't really work. And I know how it should work. When you're watching it, you know how it should be working on you,
mm-hmm.
but it's not working on you in that way. And you're curious why, and I really think it boils down to a script that they didn't tinker with enough. They thought that they had a dynamite premise, which they did, and they had Will Smith, and that was enough, and the wrong sense of direction to it. I mean, Michael Mann is the producer of this movie. He's great friends with Will Smith.
Mm-hmm.
He deserves a chunk of that Smith money. He's a great filmmaker. But this isn't his kind of movie either. I mean, and it's shot like a Michael Mann movie.
Well, it's funny because it has that one scene, the bank robbery scene, that's straight from Heat.
Right.
I'm watching that. I'm like, oh, my God, where's Robert De Niro and Al Pacino?
All right, I'm trying to see what he's... Yeah, I talked to Aaron. Aaron's a good guy. Look at the Futurist. He's always on Aaron's case.
I know, dude. I think the Futurist is Aaron, though.
It could be.
I think this is one of the greatest internet tricks of all time.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you, and I think the Bad Santa analogy is very accurate and very deserving. But, you know, the problem with this film, I would have loved it had the film stayed within... had kept the tone of the first half. And you're right, it does beg to be an R-rated film. It begs, and throughout the film, it's begging for that. And actually...
And what's wrong with that? You know, occasionally, let's get an adult film. I mean, there are adults that go to the theater, too. But I understand that the risk management and the money involved. So first of all, the premise alone, you kind of know that they couldn't sell the premise 100%. Because we don't want Will Smith not to be charming. I mean, it almost defeats the purpose of putting Will Smith in a movie. We know that it can't go as far as it possibly can, because they got to pull in a PG-13 for that amount of money that they spend on making it.
Right.
They're hedging their risks, you know, and we understand that, but it can't reach its full potential without going that far, I don't think.
No, I agree with you there. It's funny you bring up the script, because the the script has been floating around since the mid-90s. It's one of those things that's been just all around Hollywood. And it is, you know, there's something about the second half of the film, too, that for something that's been around for a long time, it feels awfully sloppy and rushed. Didn't you get that feeling?
Yeah, and you're right. The way that, another directing point, the way that Charlize Theron, who is just gorgeous. Is there a more gorgeous
one? We want Charlize Theron on the show, or just, all right, never mind.
Forget the show. But Charlize Theron is gorgeous, but the way she's directed, it is so obvious. If you understand anything about the visual language of film, that something's up from the very first scene between she and Hancock.
Mm-hmm.
The way it is directed so heavy-handedly.
It's so obvious. I mean, I'm watching this, I'm like, oh my, okay. This is not, subtlety is not one of the strong points of this film at all.
Right.
So obvious that there's something to do with these two characters, because as soon as he walks in the house, she's like, oh my God. You know?
But at the same time, I kind of think, I love Will Smith, I like him, but maybe this is wrong for him. Maybe the way this character is devised, it should have been someone that you couldn't believe as a superhero, like an anti-superhero,
mm-hmm.
like someone that you couldn't possibly place in that role.
Didn't it remind you of The Last Boy Scout in some ways, like the Bruce Willis character at times in the first, like, 30 minutes? Didn't he remind you of Bruce Willis? Kind of in The Last Boy Scout when he's drunk and everything, hungover and all that.
Yeah.
But I think the Bad Santa thing, you guys hit it right on the head.
Bruce Willis, though, he plays, Bruce Willis plays Hagrid really well.
I don't think there's a living actor who does it better.
There's a couple no, actors that have
living.
There's a couple actors that have their own niche, you know. Bruce Willis plays Hagrid really well. No one acts out pain like Mel Gibson. There are a couple of actors that have, you know, their own little place.
I like that. Pain, that was a good word there. It's a good euphemism for what Mel calls it.
Right, well, could you imagine anyone else selling that big toe sequence in Payback? Well, they smash
no,
his toes
I couldn't.
With a hammer. Mel Gibson was loving that. He was like, oh, can I slobber more in the next take, you know?
You're so
right.
Yeah,
he was like that. He was like that. Okay, I have a couple of DVDs I'd like to talk about.
Okay.
First Run Features was generous enough to, I had some interest in a couple of their titles, so they sent them over, and I watched them, and they are remarkable pieces of work. They're available on DVD now, and their website, if you could type it in the chat room, Jerry, firstrunfeatures.com.
Okay, sure thing.
The first film is a documentary, and you know how crazy I am about documentaries. It's called Beyond Hatred. And it's been making the rounds at some film festivals, but it's now on DVD. It actually won the Best Documentary at Berlin Film Festival and a special jury prize at my film festival, Sarasota. And Beyond Hatred is the story of there's some skinheads that wanted to make trouble. They were scoping the streets for an Arab, apparently, one night, and they ran across this young man who happened to be homosexual. And so they beat him and they drowned him. That's one part of the story, and that's a story that we've sadly seen too often. And there's a lot to be mined from that story alone. But what the movie's really about is moving beyond hatred. It's about the parents of this boy, their journey to transcend hatred and not let it get the best of them. It's powerful, it's emotional, it's brilliant. And I think it's an important movie.
That way from what you've said.
It's got some lessons to teach us about humanity, I think. And I would definitely recommend that. The second one, you know, these are outside of the box films. You know, they take a subject and they dare to look at the flip side of it, where you would automatically think with the last one it would be about the feeling for vengeance, where it's actually about the need to overcome that feeling. This other one is called Meeting Resistance, and it has to do with our war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks at the war in Iraq from the insurgency point of view.
I've heard nothing but good things about this. So.
Yeah, they interview members of the insurgency. They get their point of view, and this is very sensitive, but valuable, because from their point of view, they're being bombed, their families are killed or taken away. how would we feel as Americans if that would happen?
Right.
They take that point of view, and actually it is so valuable. The U.S. military is showing this movie to their recruits to let them know what they're facing. I mean, the U.S. military has taken this film under their wing. So it's required viewing.
I've heard that.
Yeah. It's an important film to watch to gain another perspective of understanding on this conflict we have over there. So two very good, strong titles that are both on DVD. Stuff that's, you know, it's valuable. You're not going to get it, and you know, you're not going to get it on every channel on TV. And they're difficult to track down usually, these kinds of films, but you can get them at firstrunfeatures.com, and I'm sure they're available in video stores too.
I think you can get them on Netflix as well, if I'm not mistaken. First Run.
Yeah.
You can get them on Netflix. And speaking of Medium Resistance, I think we should probably, because a week from tonight, if you have HBO, a very important miniseries starts from the creators of The Wire, and that would be Generation Kill, based on Evan Wright's book on the Iraq War, on the soldiers, the grunts who are fighting this war for us. And it sounds phenomenal. And if you've read the book, which I strongly recommend, by Evan Wright, who wrote for Rolling Stone. I think he still writes for Rolling Stone. Go pick up the book right now, and then next Sunday watch this, because I think we are in for a... I don't think the war in Iraq as a fictional, as a narrative, has been done right, and this might be the first thing to get it right, I think. And from the creators of The Wire, I expect nothing less.
Yeah, and from everything that I've read about it, it says that the strength of it is that it lets you decide the morality of it yourself. It's kind of an unflinching portrait of what occurs over there, the different sets of personalities over there, and you decide yourself what you think of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a preaching movie. It's
not at all. It doesn't sound that way at all.
Yeah,
it's very matter of fact, kind of almost in your face. In some ways, as The Wire was.
It's an important thing, and it's a gray line, because I think that films, to paraphrase like something that Sean Penn said on Actors Studio, I love Sean Penn because he feels that way.
Right.
He said, you know, movies are too powerful a medium to take lightly. You need to address what's going on in the world today in film, I think. But it's very delicate how you can do that, because we don't have the full picture of Iraq. We don't have the benefit of 20 years from now looking back and having a clear perception of it, you know?
Just what's happened in the last week, I think I'm more confused on a daily basis, you know, by the news that does come out and not having the full picture. And it doesn't matter how much I read, I still feel like I'm behind the curve.
Right. So it's tricky, but I think that some of the movies that have come out in terms of dealing with how it's affecting us here at home, I mean, these can kind of work as time capsule pictures where you can pull them out. That's where we were as a culture at that time.
Right. I think so. I think there are the two that I can really think of that have worked because they show the effect back home. The one that came out earlier this year, Stop Loss, and the one last year with John Cusack, Grace Is Gone. Very not seen by many at all. I think Stop Loss comes out on DVD this week, and Grace Is Gone is on DVD. But I think those two are important because they do show the effect on the soldier, but also on the family, on the loved ones. And that's very important because we're ignoring these people horribly.
And some of the most powerful movies about Vietnam for me. I mean, they came 20 years after the conflict, and yet,
right.
You know, the first. I think that we were behind the ball on Vietnam in terms of the cinematic portrayal. You know, the first ones out of the gate were Deer Hunter and Coming Home. Just a couple of years after it ended.
Yeah, and I mean, you had the one. You know, obviously John Wayne's the Green Berets, which. You know, no one looks back really fondly because it was, I think, the only pro-war. But that was, I think, right as the conflict was beginning. But then there's the one with Burt Lancaster, Go Tell the Spartans, which some people consider to be one of the best films made about the Vietnam War.
Really?
I don't know if I agree with that, but it's an interesting film. But, no, the two, Coming Home is a good one, Deer Hunter, and then obviously Apocalypse Now, which... maybe is really not even about Vietnam. It's about...
They're all very
different. It's about everything.
They're all very different, aren't they?
Yeah.
Apocalypse Now is one of the great mood pictures of all time.
Mm-hmm.
There's madness in the chemicals in the film. You know,
it's right down there.
They were living that madness, and it comes across in the movie. That's what makes the movie so extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
But Deer Hunter, obviously, I think it's a controversial film. It always has been.
Yeah, I think it always that article in Vanity Fair that we read a couple months ago about Deer Hunter and Coming Home, and especially about not very flattering on Mr. Cimino.
He's used to that kind of press. But
yeah, he is.
Obviously, Platoon took us in the actual battlefield. For me, the most powerful for me personally, the one that gets to my heart immediately, is Born on the 4th of July, because, first of all, it tells the entire scope of what the Vietnam War meant for the soldier in combat back here at home.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, that movie does it to me every time, how he's so idealistic. And there are guys like that. I mean, gung-ho. They with the best intentions, they want to serve their country. Their lives are shattered. Their lives are taken away from them, and they're spat upon when they come back home.
Right.
They're ill-treated. And yet, this is the inspiring thing, they persevere. Through all that tragedy, he ended up finding his voice and making a difference in the world. And
yes, he did.
That's beautiful to me. That's a beautiful, beautiful movie to me. It's always been one of the movies that are closest to my heart.
Right.
You know. So, who knows? I mean, maybe we'll have that level of film 10 years from now looking back at Iraq.
I think we will. I think when the conflict ends, I think we are going to see a lot more films. You know, it's weird. It's just the whole dynamics of the movie-going business and the movie-going itself, just whether the public is going to be receptive. Is it too much, you know, since that we... I don't even know if we so much that we see it on the news every day now, even, because their networks are trying to cut back on their coverage for some reason. And there are a lot of... If you read, there are a lot of reporters out there in the field who are very upset by the amount of time the 24-hour networks, as well as the networks, are taken away from Iraq coverage. It's surreal. We have two wars going on, and they're not in the daily dialogue anymore, almost.
Yeah. Who wants to read about them?
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, that's the sad truth, is that, yeah.
I'm gonna pull up something I haven't read. I wanted to read some correspondence that the movie geeks get occasionally. Let me find this email. We've had one fan in particular. We have many fans that write us, and surprisingly, from all over the world. We have no idea who we reach on the show, but this is a letter I got months and months ago, and we've been corresponding. It's between myself and a listener named Patrick. And he says about a month ago, I found your show when I was looking up new movie-related podcasts on iTunes. I'm in movie geek heaven. I listen to at least one podcast per commute so I can catch up. Your twice-weekly show is the best and most consistently entertaining show on movies and movie analysis out there.
Wow.
This is a big fan, and he's been writing. He's joined us with the De Palma interview. That's what got him.
Right. Okay, great.
So that's very nice, and we get letters like this, and I just want to – we've never had a chance to, like, stop and say thank you to all you guys that are so supportive to us. And, Jerry, can you list the people in the chat room and thank them for joining us tonight,
too? I will
too?
Thank all of them. We have Olivia, of course. We have For Directions and Laugh. We have our very good friend, Rub, one of the best critics out there. We have Betty Jo Tucker, Felix in
New Jersey. Betty Jo, how you doing?
Betty Jo. But I have to make a special for the futurists, because we all love the futurists, and everyone knows why I love the futurists, because we speak the same language. And we have some guests in there who, if you would identify yourselves, that would be great. And we also have one of our longest listeners, Barinka, who's in there,
right,
and she's wonderful.
Right.
She's been with us from the very beginning, along with the Rub, and we just love all of you.
We absolutely do. All these movie geeks need to stick together, and anyone with a passion for movies, thank you for being out there with us. Here's another correspondence we got with our Chris Carter interview. I posted it in the IMDb message board, and you know, we had technical difficulties when we had to postpone it for an hour.
Wait, hold on. Somewhere in Vegas, I didn't see you because you were disappeared off the screen. We love you too, baby.
Yeah, we love you, Summer in Vegas. Here's a correspondence that we got from our message that we posted. Hey, Chris Carter interview tonight. For those of you that didn't join us Wednesday night, we played the Chris Carter interview, but it was an hour late because we had problems uploading the interview to the server.
Mm-hmm.
So here's another fan correspondence we've received. This is from N-Ban Wait. I guess it's a screen name. He says, the idiots on the show can't upload a simple file on Windows Media Player. What a bunch of losers. It's the first time I went to their show and the last time after waiting for the interview. Morons. So, you know, it runs the gamut. People love us.
Hey, you know what? I'd say, hey, come over here and work the BTR interface. You know,
yeah,
and then tell me
you,
how
you know
feel.
What? I was so like pleased that somebody always has to say something.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
Act like, you know. So I just said I appreciate your sensitivity to the our plight, but
yeah.
In case you want to hear it, it's there. So, you know, we appreciate any correspondence. If anyone's talking about us, you know, it's good.
Yeah, good or bad.
That's just beautiful. If anybody wants to call, if you want to talk about anything on your mind, we got 20 minutes left on the show.
Yeah, we got 20. The hourglass started.
Yeah, please don't make me sit here and talk to Jerry alone for 20 more minutes.
Yeah,
it's
torture. I mean, you should hear what people have to say.
I love
stuck
you, man.
In a room with him for, I was stuck in a room with him, and all he talked about was his dog. Never mind.
Here's the phone-in number, 718-508-9477. Give us a call. Anything that's on your mind. We got some great guests upcoming, but this Wednesday we're going to relax with our third movie geek friend, Chris. Next Sunday, we're going to bring on Hal Masonberg, the director of The Plague. This is his third appearance. If you remember about The Plague, it's a movie that he finished. It stars James Vanderbeek, Dee Wallace, some really good cast
Our
members in there.
Our good friend Dee Wallace, yes.
Yeah, and he had the film taken away from him in post and re-edited. And essentially, it's one of those horror films that works as social commentary. Essentially, they took out the social commentary and just left it as like a killer kids film, like a dime a dozen kind of film. I've had the pleasure of seeing both versions, and we're going to compare both versions.
Oh,
and,
cool.
And try to boycott the studio to release his cut on DVD. So that appearance will happen next Sunday, as well as an actor that we've been keeping tabs on. It's a very interesting story. He's middle-aged. He decided, hey, you know, I'm a successful business person. I've got a family. But I've always had this nagging dream that I want to be in movies. I want to be an actor. So he set out to do it, and he's doing some movies here and there with some great talent, and he's going to give us an update on his career as it's going so far.
Oh,
Wednesday
cool.
night we have Wednesday the 16th. Is it? I don't know dates very well.
No, that's right. Yep.
The 16th.
2 days before The Dark Knight.
Right. We're going to have...
That's how I know things.
We're going to have... First of all, tell us about some of the guests we're having that night, because these are close to you.
Yeah, these are close to me. At 10:30, we're going to have Francis Abbey, the director and writer of the movie Boxing Day, which you've seen me plugging all over my MySpace and Facebook pages, and he's going to tell us all about his new movie, which I had the pleasure to work on a couple of days helping out. But he and Paul Buscetti and possibly one of the actors in the film will be on the show with us, and they'll be telling you everything you want to know about Boxing Day and how they each of them got involved in filmmaking.
Yes. And I wish you would have gone on longer because I'm trying to look up our other guests for that.
Oh, okay. Well, I can go on longer. We're gonna run the gamut because I want to know about my friend Francis has this huge fixation on British humor, and I want to know how the British comedy fits in with this film. So it's going to be a fascinating show.
At the top of the hour, we have some guests from a new movie called A Vicious Circle. I'm going to tell you who they are right now. We're going to have the director, and his name is, I have it right here. His name is Paul. I got it right here. We have the director and the cinematographer. Let me tell you what they've done, because they have some interesting credits to their name. It's a new independent film called Vicious Circle. It's making the festival rounds right now. Paul Boyd is the name of the director. Let me find the cinematographer name and look up his credits because I've always been interested in speaking to a cinematographer. His name is Dennis Maloney.
Mm-hmm.
And he has shot movies like Edmund, the David Mamet adaptation, Edmund.
Edmund's a great little film, undiscovered film, I think.
Yeah. He has shot Stuck, which is the Stuart Gordon movie that just came out.
That's both of them are Stuart Gordon. So he's got a good working relationship with Stuart Gordon. That's
yeah,
awesome.
The Contender, the Gary Oldman, Joan Allen film.
That's a great film.
Has he shot this? Did he shoot? Okay, he shot a different Brothers Grimm. I was like, did he shoot the Gilliam movie? Yeah, so I'm going to be very interested in speaking to him. So that's next Wednesday. Here's another movie that came out this weekend. Here's the trailer for it. This is actually a movie that I've seen. It's a specialty movie starring Matthew Broderick, Alan Alda, and Virginia Madison called Diminished Capacity.
The last time we talked, you said you still had headaches, dizziness, trouble concentrating. But you have improved, Cooper. Any other progress?
I've stopped throwing up when I drive.
Second panel, notice anything?
Oh.
Yeah, the arrow has to point to the character who's talking. We got the dog declaring his love for Rex Dexter.
Sorry.
Go on. Take off a few days, get better. Bring back the old Cooper.
Hi, Charlotte.
Cooper, back down among us.
How's Lloyd?
Who cares? We're done.
It's me!
It's Cooper!
Hi, Mom. You're here to shove me into that steak place your mama found.
His life's in a shambles. His home is like a compost heap.
I got a better idea than selling this house.
Wow.
Wildfire Schulte. One of them collectors gonna pay something for it.
You ought to take that money and get him something to do.
Are you gonna help me?
I can go to Chicago.
How much can cardboard be worth?
How much are your memories worth? There's mint, near mint, excellent, good, fair, poor.
Your card looks damn good.
Is damn good good?
It's near mint, mint.
You ought to let me hold it.
Don't you fret, I got it. You seen how those Cub fans are. They're nuts.
I want that card!
Oh, my God!
Hey, where's the old guy?
He needs to sell it now, before it blows his nose with it. Stole his card.
I bought it. 500's a joke.
Not my fault. The old guy's not real bright. People don't age like fine wine. They age like meat.
Cooper!
Was I ever any use to you?
You were more of a dad than my dad was.
I do have one question left for both of you.
Well, I remember what I want to remember.
Yeah, Diminished Capacity is the name of it. It's a really sweet independent movie. Great cast. The standout, without a doubt, is Alan Alda. He's playing. It's the kind of role that's a scene stealer, you know, on the page.
Mm-hmm.
The old coot that steals every scene. He's very good. He's very good. He's just you can tell he's just reveling in playing this part.
He was good in The Aviator.
He's very versatile. He is so good at playing villainy without playing villainy. There's just something that's there.
Good in a lot of 80s movies I remember watching on VHS, like Sweet Liberty and The Four Seasons. I don't know, there's something about him I always liked. I mean,
But there's always been this with Alan Alda, this genial kind of thing where you can't help but like him. And that's what works so well when he plays villainous characters. It started in, correct me if I'm wrong, but it started in, like, I think, 88 when he did an HBO movie called And the Band Played On.
I think that's right, 88 or 89, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, and then he did a River Rapids movie where he played a kind of shady guy for HBO, too.
Yeah, I remember that one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the movies, like you said, The Aviator. But he doesn't play it villainous. I mean, there's no mustache twirling, you know. There's something about him. What an incredible range! You can't help but like the man. He's incredibly talented. But he's the showcase of Diminished Capacity and the real reason for watching it. Matthew Broderick, he's good. What's the word I'm looking for?
He's Matthew Broderick.
Dependable. He's dependable as
reliable. Reliable. Yeah. Dependable. Okay. You're sort of really searching there, struggling for a word to use.
I was. I wish I was more of a thesaurus, but I am not. Virginia Madison, beautiful woman, and it's always a real pleasure to see her on screen.
It is
like a mature, beautiful, just vibrant woman. She's a very welcome presence on screen. So it's an appealing cast. directed by Terry Kinney, who is a great actor in his own right. And he came up from Steppenwolf, the theater company in Chicago.
Oh, Malkovich, right? Malkovich and Gary Sinise.
Sinise and Malkovich, yeah. Yeah, so some powerful stock right there.
Yeah, I mean, wow. And speaking of Malkovich, how cool is it that he is going to be in a Coen Brothers film in September?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just awesome. I mean, that's like... that's been waiting to happen for years, but oh my God.
I am more than anything, you know, I love Coen Brothers. This looks like more along the lines of a Big Lebowski in feel, this movie.
I was thinking that too.
Yeah, it does. It kind of feels like that. And it has a great cast, obviously. It has Pitt, George Clooney, Frances McDormand. It's got all the regulars that, you know, the Coen Brothers.
And now they got Malkovich and Tilda Swinton to add to the mix. So,
mm-hmm.
And it's got another one they've used in the past. J.K. Simmons, if I'm not mistaken, is in it.
Yes. Malkovich, there's something about him. There's different kinds of actors that I find fascinating. Malkovich always strikes me as an intellectual kind of actor, and maybe that's completely off base.
No. Did you ever read the review he wrote, or the piece he wrote about the Indian movie The Terrorist for New Yorker? I think it was for New Yorker back in the 90s.
No,
he intellectual is the right word to use when talking about him.
There are different kinds of actors, though. There's the intellectual ones, and I always felt like Bill Hurt, like William Hurt was one of those too, but you can't
mm-hmm.
beat either one of those. And then there's the intuitive actors, the emotional actors.
Right.
Those are usually the kinds that I most associate with, you know, most connect with.
Right.
But, you know, whatever gets you there, you know, it doesn't matter what your process is, whatever gets you there in the long run.
Well, let me ask you, because we're on the subject of Malkovich, and after 15 or 16 months, it's about time we got to him. But what's your favorite Malkovich movie? Can I ask you that, or just right off the bat like that?
My favorite Malkovich performance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I can tell you in a heartbeat what my favorite William Hurt performance is.
Okay, that's cool. I'll go there.
and it's no secret. My favorite William Hurt performance is The Accidental Tourist.
That's a great film.
If ever there was a role built and written for his particular brand of eccentricity, it's The Accidental Tourist.
That's a great film.
And he lets you in, but very cautiously. You know, it's a very closed off performance, but he's so good. You know where he's coming from. You empathize with him, and you can't help but fall for his character
mm-hmm.
in that movie.
I can't argue with that.
It's a very delicate feat for a performance. In terms of Malkovich, I know people mentioned in The Line of Fire, and he's great in that. Wasn't he in Places in the Heart? Wasn't he in that one?
He was in Places in the Heart. He was good in... I mean, I can't think of a movie that he's bad in, but to me there's one movie that's very little seen. But I don't think I've ever seen an actor so appropriate for a part.
You know what? I think we're thinking of the same thing. Just like I thought with William Hurt with Accidental Tourist,
mm-hmm.
there's one movie that I think is perfect for John Malkovich
mm-hmm.
that he did. I just don't know that I think it's his best performance. But go ahead, tell me what it is.
I think it's Ripley's Game.
Yes! Look at you!
And I have to say something about this. As much as I like Matt Damon as Ripley, as much as I like Alain Delon as... and I want to say Dennis Hopper, I think, plays the Ripley character
and
Wim Wenders, the American Friend. I have never seen an actor fit into a part like that, like Malkovich. It was like all his life. I mean, he's good in everything. I will say that. He is good. I'm going to even say Queen's Logic. I like him in Queen's Logic. And if anyone wants to fight with me outside, we're going to go. I'll step outside. But I like him in The Man in the Iron Mask. I know a lot of people don't like that film. I think he's great in that. He has some great lines. But in Ripley's Game, I think Patricia Highsmith's Ripley is one of the most fascinating characters.
It really is.
Very crazy character, but it's just that Malkovich's persona, they're always finding, like, who is the perfect character, and it's just Ripley. He fits into this part. There's no question. You buy him as Ripley. I mean,
yeah,
it's
you
just
do,
amazing.
And it's that sense of it's that sense that he has that he's disconnected somehow.
Mm-hmm.
He has a real disconnected feeling about him as an actor. And it works like gangbusters in the part of Ripley. I think that Matt Damon's Ripley was written a lot better.
I agree. I mean,
I think it was written a lot more challenging.
It's just as an actor, though. I think for the actor, given the persona, and given the part, you know, there's a the movie never got I think a theatrical release in this country. It went straight to video. But it's just you're watching it, and you're just like, he's Ripley. You don't doubt that ever for a moment. But no, I love The Talented Mr. Ripley with Matt Damon. I was really impressed with that film. And I know a lot of people I like, a lot of my friends hated it.
Oh, Olivia, I think, brought up something with Malkovich. This is my top Malkovich performance. I agree with you. He's made for Ripley. But I think his best performance is Dangerous Liaisons.
He's at the end. I mean, that's the first thing I remember seeing. I mean, I saw Empire of the Sun and all those, but the first thing that really stood out for me was Dangerous Liaisons.
He's great. There's something slightly effeminate about him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to put it. In Dangerous Liaisons, but so like peculiar. He's peculiar. You just can't help but watch him.
Mm-hmm.
And in that movie, I mean, he's playing a bastard that falls in love in spite of his best intentions.
Right.
It's a dynamite movie. Everybody shines in that movie.
Mm-hmm. They do.
I even forget that Keanu Reeves is in that movie. It's so good.
Speaking of Keanu Reeves, and you knew I was going to bring this up, and you can cut if you want to mute me, you can. Did you see the teaser trailer for the remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still?
Yeah.
I think you've seen the original Day of the Earth Stood Still, or at least you know of it.
Yeah.
Okay, couldn't they just call it something else? It really doesn't have much to do with the original film. it really doesn't.
Who knows anymore? I mean, who knows anything about The Day the Earth Stood Still anymore? It really holds no currency with modern audiences, sadly.
It doesn't, and I was under the impression that it's, you know, we're watching it. I'm watching the trailer with my mom. We're just like, what the hell does this have to do with the original film?
Right.
I almost burst out laughing. I mean,
it's just going to be another dumb summer movie, which is fun. But it's coming out in the fall, isn't it?
I think it's coming out Christmas.
Well, a dumb Christmas movie.
But
speaking of Keanu Reeves, look, I actually admire the heck out of Keanu Reeves. I think that there's been two or three movies that he's actually very good in.
Okay.
I think there's been two or three movies where he's been abysmal in. But even in those efforts, I admire the heck out of him because, like I've said many times on this show, I admire in an artist when their reach exceeds their grasp. When they're trying, they want to push their limits as an actor, as an artist. And I really see that genuinely in Keanu Reeves.
Oh, I see it. There are actually a couple, in all seriousness, there are a couple. I mean, I like him. I know a lot of people like to kick him around. There's some things, obviously, I think he is wooden. But there are a couple movies, like My Own Private Idaho, River's Edge. I love him in the Bill and Ted movies. Point Break, I think, is a lot of fun. I even liked him in Street Kings, if you can believe that.
The movies that utilize him
and
well.
The Matrix. You can't forget The Matrix.
Yeah, and that's the prime example. The movie that utilizes his particular set of skills well.
I think
first of all, he's very exotic looking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Olivia's fandom of Keanu has to do anything with his acting ability. I'm tempted to think probably not. But he's a great looking guy, but you see his weakness when he's put up against someone who's actually very good.
Right.
You see it come out big time, like a Pacino in Devil's Advocate, where he even raised his game for Devil's Advocate, but you could tell absolutely he's not there yet.
I always forget he's in Dracula.
That's the one that I'm talking about being abysmal. You could tell he was uncomfortable in that movie.
Mm-hmm. I always forget he's in it, though. People have to remind me. Oh, yeah, that's right. He was in that.
Yeah. But you look at the last monologue. of Devil's Advocate, and literally Pacino's dancing circles around him.
you've been wanting to say that the whole time.
I mean, that's the blocking, and that's how it comes across throughout the movie. But at the same time, he has moments that are very effective in that movie, very heartfelt.
He was good in a movie I saw on cable about Neil Cassady called The Last Time I Committed Suicide. I think this is a late 90s film. But actually, he's very good in that. I mean, he's good. Something's got to give. Olivia's absolutely right. He's very good in that.
Man, she's on her a rampage about Keanu tonight. Look at that.
She's got the resume
up. She's like ready for battle.
You know what movie I didn't like that he was in, but it just wasn't a good movie? The Watcher. I just thought that was an awful movie.
That's an actor. Man, this show's going all over the place. That's an actor that fascinates me. Talk about fascinating actors.
You need to do a show about him.
James Spader.
Yeah.
Here's a guy that acts in movies and TV, and yet he never watches movies.
I know, exactly.
That fascinates me right there. The second thing, I remember when he did Stargate?
Yeah, Stargate, the very first Stargate, yes.
Yeah, yeah. He said, they asked him, why'd you do this? And he said, I read the script, I thought, my God, this is awful. How are they going to make this? And so he wanted to be a part of it. He wanted to do Stargate because he thought it was so terrible, he had no idea.
I remember that, yes.
I thought I was in love with him from that point on. And he's a dynamite actor. He's got a great presence.
No, he was, like Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Someone brought up Lesson Zero. I mean, these are very good movies.
Yeah, and you think about how he got started. That was the role he played in all those early movies, the sleazy slime ball, rich guy.
Wasn't he also in Bad Influence?
Yes, with the, Rob Lowe, yeah.
Rob Lowe, yes, that was perfect timing for Rob Lowe, that film.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of which, this is movie related. I don't want to talk about it, though. Mini-Me has a new movie out.
Yes, he does.
Yes. But one that we won't be reviewing on the show.
No, we won't.
Yeah. Anyway, next topic.
Oh, man.
Anyway, I wonder if that would qualify as a short film in every way.
You're on a roll tonight.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. Kit Kittredge, it's not near me, so I won't have an opportunity to see that until it comes close to me. I don't think it's near me. See, I live, Betty Jo, I don't know where you live, but I live in, like, Podunk, Florida, like a little town in Florida. And so movies come to me 3 months after everyone else has an opportunity to see them, which is terrible. And people don't believe it. I'm, like, in this Podunk town in Florida. I get to talk to all these movie people. And the movie people aren't aware either, I'm sure. Florida? Well, that's not our market. Lakeland, Florida?
You gotta love the futurist. He's still asking.
My ego is out of control? What does that mean?
No, not that. No, it was something about one of our co-hosts or ex-co-hosts, but it was pretty funny.
Hancock, our full review of Hancock's earlier in the show, Jerry kind of liked it. I had big problems with it. But at the same time, I mean, it's hard to... It works. It entertained me for 2 hours, you know. I just couldn't watch it and not think of all the missed opportunities.
I'm laughing at something the futurist is typing. You better look at the futurist. Latest stop.
I know.
Oh, my God. I didn't know he was Abigail Breslin. That explains a lot. Okay.
our fan base in the chat room, well, guys are out of control. anything else going on that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I wanted to bring up something, and maybe we'll talk about it more on Wednesday night, if that's all right. But
yeah,
and we'll give you a coming attractions kind of. I was able yesterday to go downtown to see the documentary Gonzo about Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah,
and I've been thinking about it a lot because he was a writer that meant a lot to me, and I've just been thinking about it. I brought up all these books. You know, I do come prepared to the show. I do actually come to my room prepared. I brought up three books, two written by Hunter S. Thompson and a book that came out, The Life of Hunter S. Thompson Gonzo, which is sort of, I guess, based or a companion piece for the film. But if you have a chance to go see this documentary, I would strongly recommend that you go see it, especially if you don't know much about Hunter S. Thompson, because it's an excellent primer. And the people they interview who knew him or were involved in his life, it's very fascinating. But we will talk more about this, I think, on Wednesday night if we have time.
Yeah, I'd like to. And plus, I forgot to mention that starting the 23rd of this month, we'll have the first of our three-part Steven Spielberg tribute. And this one carries us from the Duel to the Indiana Jones films. And that'll be the 23rd. So we hope you guys can join us for that. Wednesday night, another nice show with a conversation with the movie geeks and your calls. Hopefully somebody will be able to call in. And we will talk to you guys on Wednesday night.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormack, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormackmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.